You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Wood.
And I'm Jennifer Connor.
From Equestrian Businesswomen, and you're listening to Equestrian B2B, the podcast that brings together industry leaders, entrepreneurs, and equestrians for conversations about how they build and sustain a successful business.
On today's show, we speak with Casey Coleman about how she started at the grassroots levels of harness racing, her climb to fame, and how she was able to retire at 45.
Casey Coleman was born in British Columbia, Canada, and grew up in the harness racing industry. Both her parents came from racing backgrounds, her dad in harness racing and her mom from thoroughbred racing. When she was young, she wanted to be a harness driver. In 2000, Casey had a life-altering accident in the barn where she was severely burned. With 22% of her body needing skin grafts, she spent 3 months in the ICU. After her recovery, she moved east to Ontario to pursue her dream of catch driving. When that didn't work out, she decided to become a trainer. With two horses in tow, she built her business from the ground up, eventually moving up to the Grand Circuit and breeding her own horses.
Casey is the first female in harness racing history to enter a horse in two $1 million races in one season. Casey passed 100 wins and $1 million in total season earnings in the process, becoming the youngest female trainer in Canada to reach such a milestone. Casey has won 5 O'Brien Awards as Canada's Trainer of the Year. She trained the 2012 Canadian Horse of the Year. In 2012, at the age of 32, Casey became the youngest trainer in harness racing history to surpass the $40 million career earnings. Casey has won many prestigious races and sent 9 stallions to the breeding shed. She was inducted into the Cambridge Sports Hall of Fame in 2014. Casey is now retired from training and currently resides in Wellington, Florida. She is still active in harness racing through ownership. She has shifted her focus to her personal fitness journey, enjoying time in the gym and at the beach. Hi friends, Connor here. I want to take a quick minute to tell you about my new endeavor. My partner Chelsea and I have developed the first peer-to-peer equestrian clothing rental marketplace. Think Airbnb for those unused clothes sitting in your closet. It's simple. You're going to rent, ride, and return. We're excited to connect equestrian closets across the country, helping to make equestrian fashion more affordable, accessible, and sustainable. So start cleaning out those closets and make some extra horse money. Check out ridersrent.com. I'm really happy to have one of my friends on today. We've been friends. I was thinking about this, Casey. You and I have been friends like for over 20 years from back in my blue chip days. And it's crazy to say that because I don't feel like we're that old, honestly.
Yeah, I don't feel that old either. I didn't even think it was 20 years. But now, yeah, it's been quite a long time. You're one of the first ones I met when I was yearling shopping, for sure.
Yeah. So Casey is in harness racing. She's a spectacular trainer. And I'm really excited to talk about her business and where she's at now, but where she came from. And so what we're going to do is we're going to start out kind of, I know your story, obviously, but I want you to kind of tell where you started, where you grew up, and how you got into it, and just give that base for our listeners.
Okay. Born and raised in the business. My dad trained horses. My grandpa trained horses. So it's been in our family forever. Vancouver, BC is Cloverdale, Fraser Downs, it's called now, is where I learned everything. And basically legit born in the barn. My parents raced nonstop, and that was their business. And I kind of had no choice. So I'm glad I liked it because I kind of had no choice. They didn't have a lot of staff. And from the time I was able to pretty much walk and do anything, I think I was working in the barn. So yeah, that's born and raised right into it. And then eventually, once I turned 20, I think it was, I moved to Ontario. It was just better purses, bigger, a lot more money and more purse money in Ontario. So I took the shot and I moved with my parents when they moved to Ontario. It was lucky I did it. It was a last minute decision. My parents said they had a mare that was very good named Fastlane Cruisin', who literally got rode out of racing there because she just kept beating everybody. They couldn't beat her. So my dad had to take her to Ontario to race, and I didn't want to go. It was my home there. My friends were there. I was a driver. I was doing half decent driving. I was like, I'm not going to get no drives. I'm not going to know anybody. I've never left Ontario, BC at the time. And I was not going. And it was literally the night before my parents were coming through with the truck and trailer. And I just said, I packed my bag and I didn't have much, thank God. It didn't take long to pack and jumped in the truck and trailer and went. And if I didn't make that move, I would never be where I ended up being, because you just simply, you can't make money in BC. Basically, my parents both had side jobs while they're there. Mm-hmm. My dad worked on a golf course and my mom worked at a gas station and had a hot dog cart, which she actually still does to this day. She likes the food trucks. And then the horses were kind of on the side. You couldn't do it as a full-time business because there just simply wasn't enough money. So very glad I made the move to Ontario, because I would not be in the position I ended up being in by moving there. So yeah, born and raised right in it. It's in my blood.
Yeah. And yeah. But you didn't always want to be a trainer, right?
No, I want to be a driver. I never wanted to be a trainer even a little bit. So as soon as I was old enough, I got my driver's license when I was the day I turned 18. That's what I did, is wrote my driver's license. That's the youngest age you're allowed to get it. Got my license right away. I won my very first start. Horse's name was Southside Pride, and he was, what was he, paid like $100. He was like 50-1 or something crazy, and I ended up winning my very first start with him. And I did pretty well driving. I only really drove for my dad and a few other people. Fastlane Phillips was a horse I won the Invitational with, where my dad actually had to have a fight with the judges because I didn't have an A license yet. And they said I couldn't drive in the Invitational. It was a legit rule. And my dad used the whole, she's a female, you're being against her because she's a female, and that's why you won't let her drive in the open. And I said, Dad, no, it's a legit rule. You must have an A license. Anyways, we kept fighting it, and I ended up winning that race also. I got able to win in the race in the Invitational with Fastlane Phillips and also won that. So I then fast forward, I end up being in a bad barn fire. After the bad barn fire, it kind of messed up my right arm and my legs, and it messed up a lot of me for a little while. I burnt 22% of my body in a barn fire, and I was told I couldn't be around horses for 2 years. I didn't listen to the doctors on any of that. Literally 2 days after, I wasn't at the barn the day after I got out of the hospital for many months because I couldn't find my truck keys. My mom had hid them. I found them. I found them the next day, went to the barn, and I was not supposed to be anywhere near a horse for 2 years because of the risk of infection. And I just wouldn't listen. But I did find out the hard way I couldn't drive. Once I moved to Ontario, it gets like minus 25 Celsius. Extremely cold, and my body could not handle the cold at all. I couldn't handle the horse at all in the cold weather with my birds. So I sort of switched over to training.
Wow. That's incredible. That's a lot, right? And how old were you when that happened?
I believe I was 18 when the barn fire. No, 19. I had just started driving about a full year. So yeah, I think I was 19 when the barn fire happened, and it was my own fault. I was heating up. I was working for a guy named Billy Davis. After the races, I was putting away my own horse who was racing the next day, which was also Southside Pride, the same horse I had my first win on. I was racing him the very next day, putting him away. I don't know if I know you guys have a lot of different horses. It's that you guys do interviews on. It's called the reducing. It's like a tar, black tar liniment. And I like to heat it up with alcohol to make it into a liquid. And I couldn't find the small bottle of alcohol, so I grabbed the gallon and poured a little bit on with the gallon. And obviously that was a very bad decision, and it just blew up. And I was saving the horse. The horse was fine, but I thought the horse was on fire because he was freaking out, and he ripped the cross ties down. He bolted down the shed row. I grabbed the end of the cross ties. I drug all the way down the shed row with him, not letting him go, just thinking he's on fire. I didn't realize he's running from me. I was the one on fire. So I burnt for quite a long time because I did not know I was the one on fire, and I was refused to let him go. And it didn't end up being a very good situation.
Right.
I was in the intensive care unit for quite a few months after that happened. So,
well, I'm so sorry to hear that. But I mean, to come out of that horrific, you know, event in your life and be able to still find a way to be with the horses and become a trainer. That's, man, it shows a lot of perseverance and love for the horses and sport, huh?
Yeah, definitely. And like I said, I still chose to keep driving. And when I was still in Vancouver, with the better weather and in the summer in Ontario, I could still drive. But when a horse grabs on too much to me, the cold weather, different things still affect me because I was actually, my right leg was supposed to be amputated. There's no muscle left in there. There's no, most of it's all, my parents had to sign a thing knowing that the right leg was, it was basically not even an option. They were told it was being amputated. Wow. And once they went into surgery, obviously the doctors, thank God, were able to save it. But because of that, I don't have a whole lot of strength like I should and feeling and muscle and everything there. And my other big problem is my arm. So yeah, just when a horse gets too aggressive or the weather conditions don't, I'm not safe in a race. I found out the hard way.
Oh, man.
So I moved to training sort of.
Yeah. Yeah. And you started your own stable, right? After you moved to Ontario?
Yes. Yes. I never trained on my own at all in BC. I was just working for my dad, driving for my dad. And it wasn't up until I moved to Ontario. And saying that, when I became a trainer, that was kind of just fluke too. I still didn't want to be a trainer. And it's basically, I was working for my parents at Flamborough Downs, the back stretch, and they're paging over the intercom. We need a trainer to fill in on a new owner seminar. Can somebody fill in? Because a guy named Billy Budd, who was a trainer, didn't show up. And my parents said to me, why don't you go do it? And I'm like, why would I go? What am I going to do? And they're like, well, go fill in. They need a horseman. And you just got to answer questions to new owners. And I thought it was a bad idea. My parents were like, you should go do it. So anyways, I went and I did it. Sat in this new owner seminar for probably about 2 hours. And really cool, just answering people's questions. I was sitting there as a driver. I was there as a driver. Now, some of the questions they asked were a lot of trainer questions too, which obviously I know, working for my dad forever and working in the barn. So I did that. Fast forward about a week later, the race office calls me and they said, there's an owner from that new owner seminar. They would like your phone number. Do we have permission to give it to them? And I'm like, why would they want my number? And we're like, we don't know, but they want your number. Can we give it to them? I'm like, okay. And I just found it was weird. So this guy named Merlin House calls me and he basically said he really liked what I had to tell him. He liked me and he's interested in getting a horse and he's interviewing me and J.R. Plant, who was also in the new owner seminar, to be a trainer for him. And whichever one he chooses is going to be his trainer. And I said, well, I think you got the wrong impression. I was like, my dad's a trainer. If you would like to talk to him, and obviously JR is a trainer, but my dad would be willing to talk to you, but I'm not a trainer. I don't even own a harness, let alone train a horse. Like, I work for my dad and I drive. And he's like, no, I would like you to train the horse. And this kept going back and forth. And I kept telling him, I'll set you up with my dad. Finally, I said, okay, I'll train you. And I knew the horse. I'd been watching a race, racing against her. Her name was Keeper Fly, and I loved the horse. My parents simply didn't have a lot of money, or they would have claimed the horse. She was in for $8,500. And I said, he said, I'm going to give you $15,000 to find me a horse. And I said, well, we only need $8,500. I know the horse I want. Wow. And her name's Keeper Fly. And fast forward, we claimed her. I'm going to say 5 or 6 in a row with her. I won my first start with her, driving her and training her. And she went right up the ladder. She ended up getting claimed off of us for about double or triple what we paid for her. We took that money, reinvested it, claimed more horses. Still end up having that horse. I claimed her back and I gave her a home for life. And she was actually a broodmare for me. Cool. She produced a horse that made just under $1 million for me named Keeper's Destiny. She was the broodmare of that horse. So she did very, very well for us. And It was just one of those fluke things. I was not a trainer at all. And I had to borrow my dad's equipment, borrow my dad's harness, brushes, blankets, halters, everything. Wow. And then he claimed a second horse and it just kept snowballing. And one of the funny parts of the story is Merlin said to me when we're going to claim the horse, one of the things I said is, make sure your trainer owns a part of the horse. So you know that they're for sure giving you 100%. Make sure they own a part of the horse. So they're not just looking for that daily training rate. And Merlin said, how much of the horse would you like? And I'm like, huh? And he goes, how much would you like? I'm like, I don't have any money. And he literally didn't know me from a hole in the ground, this guy. He gave me a quarter of the horse, which I worked off. He paid for it. Wow. And then I worked it off. And he just simply gave me a quarter that I, with over time, paid it off for him. Thank God she was winning. So we paid it off quickly. But I'm like, who does that? Like, this guy didn't know me from the hole in the ground. And if it wasn't for this guy, Merlin House, I would have never been anybody. I would still just, who knows what I would be doing. Because he just gave me the chance of a lifetime and kept investing money and we kept doing well. And saying that, probably the most expensive horse I ever bought for Merlin, I'm going to estimate, is about $15,000. Never bought big priced horses, always stayed at the smaller tracks and bought cheaper horses and did extremely well. And I literally owe everything I've got to that guy because he did a lot for me.
That's so cool. And it's really shows, you know, he saw something in you that you didn't know was there or you hadn't realized and was ready to invest in you, not just horses.
Yeah. And that's actually the exact words he said to me, is he liked me so much when he met me on the interview that he basically said that I'm investing in you. And I kept telling him, I'm not a trainer. And I basically begged him. Like, I literally, nobody, like trainers, like Jen would know this, like that, this doesn't happen. Me as a trainer, I had to take him to the tack shop to buy me equipment because I didn't have any. And I'm like, this just doesn't happen. And he did it. He's like, what do you need? And I just started buying all the stuff I needed. This guy went as much as like signing a co-loan on a truck and a trailer for me, buying me trunks, buying like all, and obviously I paid it all back over time, but he just took a big long shot chance on me. And he was not a wealthy man. He obviously got by, but he wasn't like one of these big rich owners. He was just a smaller time guy. And I sadly, a little while back, he did pass. Him and his wife have passed. His daughter, Lynette, and his son, Jim, they're still around. And I still talk to them a bit on Facebook and that. And just great family, great people. And like I said, that horse keeper flying, I kept claiming her back and I kept losing her again and claim her back. And finally, I claimed her back and said, she's not racing no more, and decided to breed her. And she ended up, it makes no sense now that I'm a yearling horse buyer, because her breeding's terrible. She is not well bred. She has terrible conformation. It's like the worst you would ever see. And I didn't know this back then. I didn't know much about babies. And it ends up I'm now sort of very good with babies. And the fact I was breeding her, and the first baby that came out, Keeper's Destiny, she was very crooked. She was a terrible looking animal. I told Merlin, we made a mistake. Let's not breed her no more. We're just going to give her a home for life. And we won't breed her no more. And I don't even want to train this horse. Like, I don't know what we're going to do with the baby, because like, it's terrible looking. I gave the baby to I had over 100 horses at this point in time. So I gave the baby to my dad. And I said, you can have this baby. Merlin wants to give it a chance. I think it has zero chance. You train her, see what you can do with her. Fast forward, she didn't race till she's a late 3-year-old, which normally we race our horses at 2. And her name is Keeper's Destiny. And I'm sure Jen's going to know her, because she raced the opens at Yonkers for years and she made just over $1 million. So the mare, I didn't breed her for probably about 5 or 6 years, because Keeper's Destiny still was this terrible looking individual. And I'm like, why would you breed her? And then I end up breeding her again, where she missed a bunch of years. And she had a horse named Sports Keeper who races at Yonkers. He's made like $500,000. It makes zero sense for anybody knowing breeding and knowing conformation, because her babies are all crooked like her, and her breeding's terrible. And it just worked.
But they're good.
They're good.
And they got a lot of heart.
Yes. Oh. So there's no rules sometimes. Like, I'm a big conformation freak. I'll let breeding go, but I need them to have very good conformation. And these babies didn't have conformation, and they didn't have breeding, and they were good race horses. So
yeah, but
you never know.
Now that you're, you know, you do breeding and you are looking for babies, do you find that she and her babies were just the exception, and the more rule you follow gives you better chances?
Yeah, like definitely with her, what she taught me with herself and with her babies is horses have to have heart, lungs, and heart. And everybody wants perfect conformation, well-bred, everything like that. And if they don't have heart and they don't want to do it, you're screwed. And that horse, Keeper's Destiny, like, she was very lame. She had a lot of lameness issues, terrible conformation, not the best. Like, there wasn't a lot good about her that way, but her heart was as big as her chest. Like, it just, and saying that, like, she was only a cheaper claimer, but she tried so hard. And she just taught me a lot what a heart will overcome on a horse. I've had many very expensive, good looking, perfect conformation, sound, well bred horses, and they can't go none. They're terrible. They just don't want to do it. They got no heart and they won't beat nobody. Whereas her, and then she threw it to her babies, thank God, because she just had a heart of gold, that's for sure. She didn't want nothing to beat her. So she was a great horse, and she lived out her life till she was pretty old before she finally did pass. She lived out a great life, and I'm glad I was able to give her a good life, because even when we stopped breeding her, she was too lame to even have a baby anymore. And I said, listen, let's just give her a home and leave her in the field and let her live it out. And I'm going to say she went till, I don't know, 22, 23. And she definitely, my car license plate used to say "Keep her flying," and I got a big wind picture of her here in my house. And I'll never forget that horse.
That's so cool. So once, you know, you had your first owner and, you know, this first successful horse, when did it progress to you like actually considering yourself a trainer and kind of having a business.
Yeah, and that was Merlin. I got a credit for that. So he wanted to claim a second horse. He finally said, we still had just Keeper. And he said, I'd like to claim another horse. And he told me what amount of money I had. And I found the horse I wanted. His name was Turnyane. And I remember telling my dad, and this is something like my parents have been great to me. They helped me a ton. But I remember telling my dad, I'm going to claim another horse and I'm working for him. And I get it. Being a person that now was an employer, that some of my grooms had horses on the side, you never wanted them to have horses on the side. Like, definitely you didn't get the same work out of them. And maybe they're taking stuff out of your barn that you didn't know that they're taking and stuff like that to feed their horse. And anyways, I told my dad, I'm going to claim this horse. And my dad said, no, he said, you can have the one horse and not two. And we're arguing back and forth with it. I was living with my dad, drove his truck, worked for him, drove for him, had Keeper. And he said, no. Well, what did I do? I went and I claimed the second horse. So my dad came in the barn the next morning. He sees this horse. And he's like, "What? Who's that?" And I said, his name's Turnyane. I claimed him last night. This didn't go over well. And I don't blame him for not going over well. It went over very badly. I literally took a horse in each hand, Keeper flying and Turnyane. I quit my dad. I walked out of the barn and I'm walking down the Flamborough backstretch. And I'll never forget this guy named Jack Mollenbacher. He's like, kid, what are you doing? And I sat there with a horse in each hand and telling him my story. I'm like, well, I just quit. My dad went nuts and I don't know where I'm going to live. I don't have a harness for these horses. I don't have anything, but I have my horses. And Jack said, listen, my son, Sean Mollenbacher, he needs some help. He goes, bring the horses in the barn. I'll give them stalls, use my equipment, use my feed, help my kid out with training his horses, and I'll set you and I'll take care of everything for you. So I took it. I was like, thank you. And I put the horses in the barn, left my dad. We weren't speaking for a little while. We're all good now, but went and packed up everything in the house, moved out. I literally was pretty much going to live in my truck. I was buying programs. I went to the grandstand to buy programs, and the lady there, her name's Jackie. And I just talked to her every day. She's the program selling lady. And she's like, you're not right. Like, what's up with you? And she just could tell I was different than usual. I told her the story and she said, you know what? It's not exactly a room, but it basically was a large closet. It was a large closet, no window. It wasn't even a door. It was one of those things like a closet, like one of those towel closet doors. Had a bed in it. And she said, it's just me and my daughter. You're welcome to stay here until you get something on your feet. I took it. I'm like, I'm going to take it. So I literally lived in Jackie's closet for a while. And my parents didn't take the truck from me. Thank God I kept the truck. And then I was working for Sean and Jack. And Merlin came to the barn all the time. Like, he loved his horses. Came to the barn all the time with his family. And he could see how hard I was working. Like, I was getting up at 4:35 in the morning. And I'd be done at 9:10 at night. Like, it was nuts. Like, I was working stupid hours. And we were... So he said to me, he said, how many horses do you think you need that you don't have to work for somebody else, that you can just work for me and not work for somebody else? And I said, I don't know. I've never done this. Like, I don't know. And I said, the biggest thing is I don't have any equipment and I'm using all of other people's equipment. And that's when he took me to the tack shop, bought me all the equipment I needed. And we ended up just claiming more and more horses. And I'm going to say I got up to probably 7 or 8 horses, which Jen knows being a stand, like, this is a lot, like, to be on your own. It's a lot. Like, I was working stupid hours. And finally, I'm like, I think I need to hire myself a groom. Like, I can't do this no more. So I hired one groom and things just snowballed and just one thing led to another. And it just kept snowballing. So it was Merlin. He's seen how hard I was working. He said, how many horses do I need to get you that you don't have to work for somebody else? And that's we just kept going forward. And I started with one horse. At one point, I was at 130 horses. And that's when I capped it off. I wouldn't go no higher than 130. I was like, this is too much.
Yeah, so that sounds like a lot. When you had the 7 and 8 horses with Merlin, were you driving them too?
Yeah, I was still driving a lot for quite a while. And then I started, it was wintertime when I stopped driving. My arm literally froze in the middle of a race. It was actually one of my dad's horses I was driving. His name was Oily Cam. And my middle of a race at Georgian Downs, my arm froze on me. And I'm a right-handed whipper. And Pat Houdon, who I knew from BC days also, but this was Ontario, I'm locked in the hole and he's first over on the outside. And I've now put my whip under my arm and I put my arm through the handhold and I can't fit. And he's looking at me and he's like, what are you doing? I said, I don't know. I can't feel my arm. He goes, what do you mean? I said, I don't know. And I said, I literally can't feel my arm. And now my legs started going. And I was like, I'm in trouble. I come off the track. My dad's losing his mind. He's like, well, obviously, I just drove this horse all over the racetrack. Like, it was ridiculous. Yeah. And I was like, I don't know what's going on. Grab the horse, grab the horse. I got off. I could hardly walk. My arm was just a mess. And they had to rush me into the hospital, and I was just frozen. Everything was frozen. Wow. So I found out the hard way I cannot drive. My hands were, to this day, like, I live in Florida now. Very rarely does it get cold. When it does get cold, which cold here is like, it's not cold. Like, it's like, I don't know, 10 Celsius. Like, it's not cold. My hands will still go white to this day. When it gets like cold temperatures for Florida, yeah, they just go, I have no circulation and feeling. So
yeah.
That's when I gave up driving then, obviously, because I was going to kill somebody. And then I did so well with the drivers. And in the meantime, the barn got bigger and bigger and bigger. And I did well with the drivers. And I just stopped driving. And it obviously ended up being a good thing. I found out I'm not a very good driver, but a better trainer.
When you had Merlin as an owner, did he allow other owners to come in the barn as well?
Okay, so this was a problem. So Merlin, I wouldn't be nowhere here without him. So the first, I want to say I went about 2 years with just Merlin, and things were awesome. We got along fantastic, and it was all, he would own 75% of the horse, and I would own 25% of the horse is the way we did it. And it was about 2 years later, and the first owner that approached me was Steve Calhoun. He called me, and I never really raced Woodbine, the WEG circuit, which is the grand circuit, the good horses. I was pretty much Flamborough, London, Georgian.
We consider them B-tracks.
Yes, right. B-tracks. Okay. We had a few horses that went to the A-track, which was always awesome. Like, I felt like I was like, holy smokes, I can't believe I'm racing a horse here. But very rarely did we have a horse just that caliber to race the A-track. So Steve Calhoun calls me. He's a big owner. He's with Joe Stutzman. I know the name because I see him in all the races, winning races left, right, and center. And he says, I really want to get some horses with you. And would you consider racing? Why don't you race at the A-track at Woodbine? And I'm like, well, I don't have horses good enough for Woodbine, first off. And he goes, it was big money. He's like, I want to claim you horses, 60, 80, 100,000, like whatever you want. Wow. I want to claim you horses. My best horse at this time is about a 15,000 claimer. And I'm like, what the hell? And he goes, he was with Joe Stutzman. He was looking at, which Joe Stutzman was the root, like he was the king. He was winning everything. And Steve Calhoun basically said, I'm with Joe Stutzman. And I think he had horses with Fred Hoffman, I believe. And he said, I want to give you a chance and start claiming horses with you. And it won't interfere with any of your other horses because I don't want to race those small tracks. I just want the A track. So I call Merlin, tell him the situation. I said, this guy won't interfere with you. He wants to claim me horses. We're only going to race the A track. What do you think? Merlin thought it over. He called me, said, Casey, I'm not going to tell you what to do. I realize it's a big opportunity for you. I'm not going to tell you what to do. He said, but saying that, I really like the way things are. I like that I'm very hands-on. You're very hands-on with me. I'm your only owner. I really like it. Things are going fantastic for both of us. We're making good money. We're having fun. I don't really want to change that, but I'm not going to tell you. He didn't give me an answer. I'm not going to tell you yes or no. So I went out and I started claiming horses with Steve Calhoun, and things snowballed. Like, it just kept going. We kept winning races now at the A track, same as we were with Merlin at the B track. And one thing led to another. Once, I guess people thought I was just a private trainer for Merlin, because once I took on Steve Calhoun, then it really went wild. Then people were calling me left, right, and center to train for them. And I just kept taking them. And fast forward on that, down the road, Merlin ended up deciding he was going to leave me. He ended up deciding his horses were still doing well, but he liked the smaller stable. My stable got big. He liked being in, like, I would give him as much time as I could, but he would come and I'm busy. Like, I'm always, I was traveling a lot on the road racing. I was busy, stupidly busy. Had a lot of staff. Now it wasn't just me and one or two grooms. Now it's me and 50 grooms. Like, it's like the barn got big. He decided he was going to leave. I recommended that maybe try my dad. He went elsewhere. I recommended him not to go where he went, but he chose where he went. It didn't go so good for him for a little while, and I felt bad about that. But saying that, he came back and he went to my dad, did well again with my dad, still kept horses. Like, we still kept in contact. He still kept horses with dad eventually, but he just preferred the smaller stable. He didn't want a trainer with a lot of horses. Still wished me luck all the time. We still got along great. So it wasn't like a bad feeling split, but we did split. And I wish that never happened. I would have loved to been able to. I did put him in on a couple babies here and there. And for whatever reason, I just couldn't have any luck for him with the babies. Like, I do quite well with babies. And I put him in on a few that were, because he wasn't like a real wealthy man. So I put him on a one that didn't cost a lot of money. And I simply didn't have a lot of luck with the ones I put him in on. So I kind of wish that he would have hit one of those home run horses. I'll never forget with Merlin, we had a homebred out of that mare keeper's Destiny Sports Keeper. I entered him in a gold, which is our, so we have grassroots and gold. So it's like the B division's grassroots and the A division's a gold. So he was winning grassroots, the sports keeper. And I told Merlin, I'm going to put him in the A division in a gold. And Merlin's like, no, don't do it. He's not good enough. I don't think. I said, I'm going to put him in a gold. He's good enough. So I put him in a gold and it was about $100,000 purse, which I'm going to say Merlin's biggest purse before that would be like, I don't know, say 10,000. The horse won the race. He literally won the race. And Merlin, it was so, I was so happy for him. Like, I'm telling you, he was crying. He was so excited. It's like he just thought he won the North American Cup or the Breeders' Crown, like $1 million race. Like, he was so excited. And I was just so happy for him to win that gold. And that's literally his biggest win. And it was with our homebred. So it was a pretty special day, but that was pretty cool.
Wow. What's kind of the time span of, you know, getting your second owner to when you had over 100 horses in the barn? And were all these horses like at racetrack barns or did you have like a home base?
So when I was with Merlin, when I started, I was always at Flamborough Downs, which was the racetrack. And I was there for quite a few years. So I started, I'm going to say I got up to about 15, maybe 20 with just me and Merlin. And that was about a 2 year, I'm going to estimate it was about 2 years. Just me and Merlin got up to 15 to 20 at Flamborough Downs. Once I let Steve Calhoun in, it snowballed quickly, extremely quickly. It's just like people, once I went to the A track and I was winning, I was turning owners down. I couldn't keep them all happy. Like it was nuts. I simply couldn't get enough stalls and staff and just couldn't do it. And I'm going to say that I went from the 15 to 20 in the 2 years to 130 in probably a year, maybe two. Goodness. Like it was quick. It was crazy how quickly it happened. I was always, and I had all those horses at Flamborough Downs up until they closed. They literally closed the back stretch and I had to look to move. I didn't want to move. And I ended up going to Classy Lane Training Center after that. And then I ventured out into the States and then I was doing dual operations. At one point I was doing my Canada operation at Classy Lane. Anthony Beaton was the main guy in charge of that barn, my head assistant trainer. And then I opened up Showplace Farms in New Jersey with Andrew Harris, who was my head guy there that ran that stable. And then I also opened up in Florida for winter training eventually. So I had a stable there also. But just thank God for real good staff over the years because I was like a yo-yo all over the place and ran many stables and many different operations for quite a few years. But yeah, once I let Steve in, it just really, really snowballed. It got real big real quick.
And you're still in your early 20s at this point.
Yeah, I'm going to say I was 22, I'm going to estimate, when I claimed Keeper Flying. And so I know American Ideal was in the year 2005. And that was one of my first real good Grand Circuit horses. So yeah, I think it was 2002 I opened up. And 2005 was my first Grand Circuit horse. So, and one of my first real good horses that got American Ideal, I want to say, is actually Jen has him, is a horse named Our Lucky Clean. That horse is very special to me. He was, I claimed him for $40,000 as a 3-year-old. He went for $60,000 with allowances. He went on and made us over $1 million. He won all kinds of big Grand Circuit races. Just an unbelievable horse. And because of him, Mac Nickel, the owner of him, trusted me with American Ideal as a 2-year-old. He said, I'm going to send you another horse. And if I didn't do so well with Our Lucky Clean, I would have never got American Ideal. And American Ideal is the reason that I went to the States for the first time, the very first time I started racing Grand Circuit and the very first time I went to the States and the things that that horse did. He really put me on the map. So let's say our Lucky Clean started it and then American Ideal really capped it off. And once I won Grand Circuit stakes with him, that was the reason people ended up asking me, we want you to train babies now and younger stock, and just everything snowballed again.
Yep. Shout out to Luck Dog, hanging out, retired, loving the retired life. But he's a great horse. He's a great, great horse.
He was a cool dude. I want to say one quick story I told Jen. She was, when she took him for retirement, she told me she was going to do the retirement for standardbreds shows. They have these shows for retired standardbreds. I just thought you're riding them. Like, I know she's been riding them, and I just thought you're riding them. I did not think you actually hook them in a cart again. And you would think that a standardbred hooked in a cart, well, that's no big deal. Well, Lucky had a very big quirk where you literally would hook him in a jog cart, and every once in a while, he'd decide today's not the day, and he literally would stop and even go backwards and go quite quickly backwards sometimes. And I never thought to tell Jen this quirk because I didn't think he's ever going to be in a jog cart. I thought she's just riding him, maybe jumping him. I don't freaking know. And she told me, well, I went and I put him in a really big cart. Like, it's one of those big fancy carts, I think, the way I understood it. And
it's a four-wheel cart.
Yeah. And he started going backwards. And I'm like, oh my God, I felt so bad because I didn't even warn her about the backwards thing, not knowing he's going to go in a cart.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. He turned out fine, though. And honestly, the only one who he went backwards on most was his former groom, Mario, came down to the horse show because he was so proud of him. He has a tattoo of him and everything, and he loved him. And so he came to his very first natural standardbred show, and I let him drive him. And Lucky was like, no, bruh. I had to run and rescue him in the middle of the class. But he wasn't bad for me, but we didn't do too much driving with him after that.
when jumping. When Lucky decided it was a no-go day, it was definitely a no-go day. There literally was days, I usually did most of the track work myself with Lucky, and there was days I would stand there, I'm telling you, I felt like it was an hour sometimes, and I have a lot of horses in the barn to train, and he would literally just stand there. What he would do is, you go on his terms. If you decide you're going to start telling him, let's go, Luck. No, it was you go on his term. And we would just stand at the top of the track and he would just stand and watch all the horses jogging and training. And he simply wouldn't go. And then finally, when he decided he's going, okay, he goes. And Lucky was known to tie up. He was a bad tie up horse. And if you would tell him to go when he didn't want to, A, he would tie up, or he would just have a little meltdown. And he had an attitude, a mind of his own, that's for sure. But to do the things he would do on the racetrack, you dealt with what he wanted to do. He was the boss, and that's the way it was.
Yeah, he's the best. He was like one of those horses, you could ask him to jump a table and he's like, yeah, fine, whatever, it's stupid, but okay, I'll do it. Like, he did whatever I asked him to do. He hunter paced, he went western, he jumped, people borrowed him many times to go camping on him. I mean, they're like, he ties to a trailer. I'm like, yeah, no shit. Like, he's a standardbred. He'll do whatever you want.
I remember one thing he would do, and I think you said he did it to you, Jen. I don't think I warned you about this either because I didn't think about it, is if you have a bucket upside down beside him in the paddock, he would, like, a groom sometimes put a bucket upside down because they're going to just sit on it while they're waiting, and they'd sit on it. Lucky, if it was close enough to him, he would get up on the bucket. He would stand on the bucket.
Yeah.
And the first time he did it, we're like, what the hell? And he's just up there standing on a bucket. And I think he did it to you too,
yeah,
Jen.
He did. But, he sure
it's
did.
It's just he was like more of a dog or something than I don't know. It was he was an interesting horse and unbelievably talented horse, thank God, because he went on to win the things he won for me. That's why Mac Nichols sent me American Ideal. If I would have done no good with Lucky, he would have never sent me another horse. And he sent me American Ideal from that. And then things really, really snowballed. So,
yeah. How did you keep track of all the horses when you had 132? Like, how did you make sure that they were getting taken care of the way you wanted to? I know you have Anthony and Andrew, but like, how did you make sure? Did you have like a certain set of protocol? Did they just come up underneath you and knew what you expected? Like, how'd you keep on top of that?
Yeah. So basically, one thing I'm blessed with is my memory is ridiculous. Like, I literally wasn't even a person that writes things down a lot. Like, I legit, my memory's stupidly good, thank God. Only with horses, nothing else. Only with horses. And Andrew and Anthony, like, I got them. Like, Anthony was one of my very first assistant trainers, and Andrew was very close to being one of the first ones also. They worked for me for, I don't even know, I'm going to say 10, 12 years at least they work for me. If it wasn't for those two guys who are now on their own, I'm now an owner in their barn. They're on their own. They both have very big stables themselves. They're doing very well. Anything I'm sending to Canada goes to Anthony. Everything that's going to Jersey, the States, goes to Andrew. But those guys helped me a ton, being extremely good assistant trainers, and just the staff behind it. You just had to really trust your staff, make sure that they're working just as hard as you. And I treated them well, paid them well, make sure that you're keeping them happy. And yeah, if it wasn't for the unbelievable staff I had, I could have never managed what I managed, because it was a lot. And I can remember a horse's equipment. Everybody's always like, I literally would be walking down the shed road, be like, that horse has the Murphy on the wrong side. That horse needs a head pull. That horse needs one. I don't know why or how, but I just remembered those things all the time on every horse. And I went through a lot, like a lot of my horses were claimers. When I started out, it was all claimers, no stakes horses. So the year I'd go to the track with five or six horses and come home with, lose all those in claimers and come back with five or six new ones. And that happened quite frequently. And somehow I just always could remember what their equipment was, thank God. That was just one of the things I was blessed with somehow, I guess, bred in me, I guess. But I don't know how to explain it, but I just could always remember each horse and what they need. And every horse horses different too. Like some horses are tie-up horses, some horses are bleeders, some horses are lame. So like it's all, so they, and they all had a different protocol of what you needed to do with them to have them at their best performance. So yeah, just a lot of long hours. I literally went 24/7. Like it was crazy. Like if you got a chance to sleep was win-win, because I was nonstop 7 days a week for a long, long time. But yeah, just a lot of hard work, that's for sure.
Yeah. Lots of hard work. And you also, so you, when did you kind of like not get on the track as much and you started to like be on the sidelines watching the horses and dictating what you wanted to do instead of sitting behind them yourself?
Yeah, so multiple different reasons when that became, one being the winter time with the burns, even training would hurt me. And the other being I just simply had so many horses. So when I got up to as many horses as I had, you can only sit yourself on so many horses a day and you can't see all the other horses. So I'm like, well, what good's this doing that I'm sitting behind whatever it might be, five or six a day when I had 100 to watch? So what I started doing, and even when it was cold, I'd be at Classy Lane in the freezing cold standing up on, there's like a hill by a rock, and I'd be up there all the time and I'd watch every horse go. I didn't need to really make notes. I would make notes on some things, but just, I could just remember things. I'd be like, this horse is off here. That horse needs the vet. This horse needs equipment change. That horse needs more or less hobble. I could see every single horse. So I like training in sets. My horses would always be in sets of three, four, five at a time. If I'm one of the ones sitting in the set with a horse, I just found that I can only help the horse I'm on, basically. I couldn't see it. You can't see every horse. And I just found, and some people kind of like, they like thoroughbreds, obviously trainers don't sit on their horses. They watch every horse. But in standardbreds, people kind of, other trainers kind of diss how I do it because they're like, oh, she doesn't even go on the track. Like, what the hell? Well, I was a driver and drove in races. A lot of horses. It's not like I don't know how to handle a horse, but you do get people making like saying smart stuff that I'm not sitting on the track. And I'm like, I am at the barn every day, all day, work my butt off. And I see every single horse on the track. And to me, I'm sorry, but it's better to me to see every horse than to sit behind them. Every once in a while, I still sit behind one if I needed to. But realistically, I'm like, once I got used to it at first, maybe I missed it. But once I got used to it, I'm like, in between watching them all on the track, then when they're done training, I'd be in the barn doing things I need to do in the barn. I'm on the phone. We didn't have online entering back then. I feel like it's like I'm old now and the goal is like the ice ages, but now we have online entering. That wasn't heard of. I had to call this track by 9 o'clock, this track by 10:30, this track by 1 o'clock. Like they all had different box closes and I'd have alarms set on my phone. I'm like, I got to enter horses, make driver changes, talk to judges, talk to owners, talk to staff. So I would be on my phone talking to owners, drivers, race offices, whatever, as I'm watching horses train. And I was always multitasking, like you had to be able to multitask. And I just simply couldn't be on the track. And when I could be doing much more benefit for my stable and my owners and myself, and while I was in the barn and watching from the sidelines. So it was a big change. I like it. And to this day, you'll still hear people say, oh, she doesn't sit behind the horses. She's not a trainer. She doesn't sit behind the horses. Well, just because my butt's not on the jog cart, I'm working more out. Those people that are saying that, I know I put in a lot more hours than they do. And it's just the way it is. I'm like, maybe if you work this hard, you'd do good too. But
and also, you have some great staff that you have come work for you. I mean, you have Hall of Fame guys that sit behind your horses that can give input too, right?
Yes, my staff was amazing. I was very, very fortunate as I was getting bigger and bigger in my stable horse sizes that I was able to get the staff I got. Like I said, just using Anthony and Andrew again, they were godsend that I was able to get them in my barn. Another guy that's doing really good on his own that was one of my main guys was Gary Murner. He's doing very good on his own now also. And then, yeah, when Jen just said like Hall of Famers, like I had guys like Steve Condren worked for me for many years down here helping me break and train my babies, and he's just amazing. I'd have guys like Brad Kramer was a very good guy, like all kinds of very, very good trainers that I had in the, like, I feel bad I'm going to be missing out names. I had so many, which is such a huge stable. And also like the drivers, like guys like Dave Miller come in and help me train the horses. He'd always be willing to put in a hand. Randy Waples, who unbelievable Hall of Famer, and he helped me train the horses. I had a lot of very, very good hands on them. And my caretakers and grooms, like I had so many good caretakers and grooms. And if you don't have good people that are doing that with the horses, those are the guys with the horse 24/7. And right. I would tell them if the horse has a pimple on them, like, I don't care how small of an issue you think it is. If it's a small little bit of snot, little sneeze, a cough, a pimple on them, I need to know about it. I need to see it. And they were so good. I said, nothing's ever a dumb question. And I would always make sure, because some of them would get scared, think, oh, this is just minor. Maybe she doesn't want to know. She's too busy. And I would make them know, no, tell me everything. And they always did. And you're able to fix a problem before it was a huge problem when it was still a small problem. So,
yeah,
I great credit to my staff. If I didn't have an amazing staff through the years, I would have not got anywhere.
And I think, too, you're always good to your staff as far as what you paid, but also like doing barn parties and bringing in food and doing barbecues and just including them in being part of that atmosphere.
Yeah, I'm a big believer, and I was the staff for a long time. I groomed for many different people, and I was a big believer. Whenever I was treated good, you want to work harder. You want to help that person. You want to win. So yes, I always gave them big win incentives. Like if they got very large win bonuses if their horse won, which I thought made them work harder. And yeah, like Jen said, any win, I'd bring in coffee and donuts for everybody. I'd bring in lunches. I'd do catered barbecues. I'd have them to my house, do big steak barbecues. I'd take them to Ruth Chris Steakhouse. And this is like the Keg Steakhouse. Christmas parties, I'd have 75 people there paying for steaks and lobster for everybody. It costs me a lot, but it pays off in the long run. The better you treat people, the better they treat you. I would always fill up the fridge would be loaded with drinks and beers and alcohol. And like, everybody have a drink, let's chill. And I don't want to look back at the credit cards to see how much money I probably paid out over the years, because it was a lot. And I'd keep them fully like shirts, hats, jackets, stable stuff all the time. I even had as much as a stable horse, where I would always claim one horse that was under what was called by a mile stable, and all my staff owned an equal percentage of that horse. And I will say, one year it kind of went poorly for me. We did extremely well, and it was a large staff, and I believe the bonuses were, I think it was something like $15,000 to each groom, might even been a bit more. And I paid them all out their Christmas bonuses, and a whole bunch of them decided to take their Christmas bonuses, quit, claim their own horse, and go on their own. And I lost a lot of staff all at once at Christmas time. So I found out that was a bad idea. So some of those people down the road came back looking for their jobs back again, said, I made a mistake, can I come back? But that hurt me a lot. That's kind of, I lost a lot of staff all at one shot. And that really hurt. So yeah, treat them good, but maybe be careful you don't treat them too good. I went as much, like when you brought up Mario, when he had a big year with Our Lucky Clean and Moving Pictures, I took him to Las Vegas with me. I paid his trip to Las Vegas. And many times I took the staff. I know Anthony and Andrew, I took them to, we went on a Caribbean, I rented a house in the Caribbean for like a week before. So lots of things like that. We were very good friends and still are very good friends with a lot of them, besides just being workers and employees. So,
but one of the things that I like is that you have, like you said, you have some of the guys that went off on their own. Recently, I was listening to a girl who worked for Todd Pletcher, and she's on her own now in Saratoga, but like she literally made a plan with Todd to go out on her own. And she said, hey, listen, like I've worked for you for, I don't know, 5 or 6 years. In the next year, I want to go out on my own, but I don't feel comfortable yet. Can you help me get to that point? And then like they interviewed him saying, yes, I knew she was capable and I wanted to help her go out on her own and she's going to do a great job, but they made like a year plan. Did you do anything like that with your guys?
Not exactly. So kind of how ours went is they were still both working for me. So how it happened with Andrew is I'm trying to think which one went on their own first. I believe it was Andrew. Yes, it was Andrew. I decided I'm not going to run the racehorse stables no more through the winter. So I was coming to Florida now, and I wasn't going to winter race anymore. So with Andrew only had winter racehorses for me. And I kind of said, I'm going to die down the winter racing. And he was seeing we're getting less and less horses, and he wasn't making as good of money as he was, because he also, besides what I don't believe I changed his weekly wage, but he would get a percentage of what the horses made also. So it was getting less, obviously. He kind of said, listen, I think I'm going to start going on my own. And he wasn't like leaving me. He still wanted to train some horses for me, but I'm going to start going on my own and see if I could get some owners and go on my own. Obviously, I let him use what he needed to use. Like I still had truck and trailer and equipment and whatever, and he used what he needed to use. And he went on his own, and he snowballed. Like he did extremely well. And right now he's got probably one of the richest, wealthiest owners in the business. And they're doing extremely well right now. He's got a stable I could only dream to have ever had right now with the kind of horses he's buying. Basically, this guy will buy him anything. Like they literally bought a horse for $1 million. So things are going extremely well for him. But yeah, he kind kind of how it happened is I got smaller and smaller. And I remember me and Andrew are very tight. We always were. We still are. And he sent me a big, long email, which we always talk on the phone. We text. And he didn't know how to bring it up to me. And he goes, I think I'm going to try to go on my own. And he didn't know how I was going to take it. And he sent me a great big long email. And I was like scared to lose him because I'm like, what am I going to do without him? But he still helped me and still does help me to this day. He still has horses in his barn for me. So whenever I was sending horses to the States, even though he was on his own, he would still help babysit mine, I'd put it. Like it would be in my name as trainer, but I wouldn't be there and he'd be babysitting it for me. And Anthony, he was coming to Florida. He was coming to Florida a few years. His wife was coming with him, Lisa, and she works from home and she was able to work from home. Off the computer, and it got to be too much. I think she needed to stay her job, like being in Toronto, and just the traveling back and forth, having two homes. They had their home in Canada and then their place they would rent here for the winter. I think it just got to be too much, and they're like, listen, we're gonna stay for the winter in Canada. And again, I just didn't have enough horses for him to keep him employed and keep him going. So kind of the same thing. He gave me notice and he gave me plenty of notice. And I just shut down the racing operation. It really, really hurt to lose those two guys. And it's probably another reason when I started downsizing, I simply couldn't train the amount of horses that I did when I had guys like that able to run my operation. I ended up getting a guy named Mark McKinnon who took over after Anthony, I believe, is when he kind of came on. He was great. He was awesome. And he was able to go back and forth with the Florida and Toronto thing. He did a great job for me. But yeah, I definitely had to downsize the stables once they decided to go on their own. And they're in a way like my kids watching go on their own, I guess. Like I think they both got probably 50 horses each and doing very well. So I'm very proud to see how good they're doing.
You know, kind of shutting down the winter operations was maybe the first step to, once you got to that huge level, then starting to scale back and become a smaller operation. And from there, you know, what kind of decisions did you have to make in order to, you know, still have, you know, be making a profit or have a financially viable business after you started scaling back?
Yeah. So basically when Anthony and Andrew both weren't, I wasn't going to winter race, which meant no more claimers. And that was a lot of my stable. Like I had a lot of overnight horses and claimers. So I decided let's just focus on babies. I was pretty good at buying babies at the yearling and focusing on babies. So that's what I changed my operation to. I only train 2 and 3 year olds now. I don't keep any older horses and no claimers and just focus on quality over quantity. And just downsized a lot and it ended up working out very, very well for me because I had a lot of extremely, like I was literally, it ended up that I was honestly making more money profitable with a whole lot less horses just because of the kind of caliber of horses they were. I got very lucky on selecting some extremely talented young horses that went on to be stallions and won a lot of grand circuit races. And so I end up focusing on, that's what I do. Once they turn three, or sorry, when they're three turning four, if they're good enough to go to stud, fantastic, or sell as a broodmare, great. But I would just sell them on ongate.com if they weren't going to be good enough to go to a stud or be a broodmare, I would sell them. And my owners all knew that. And I said, if these horses aren't winning grand circuit races, I'd had horses that hadn't even raced before and I'd just start selling them right away. I said, if I don't think this is a grand circuit horse, I don't want it in my barn. So that's what I started doing. And I got my numbers eventually down to around 20 horses is where I was comfortable with the staff I had and no winter racing. And I would just be, my stable would only be here in Florida from like November till say end of April. And then we would ship the stable north to Canada with around 20-ish and all just 2 and 3 year old stake horses. And I did that for a number of years. And what I end up seeing once I end up going doing what I'm doing now is I absolutely love Florida. I love it here where I live and I loved racing. I love going and winning grand circuit races with these horses in Canada, but it was a lot. I just found going home to Canada, I was kind of like half depressed. I'm like, I don't want to go to Canada. It's the weather's not the same. The restaurants aren't the same. My friends aren't the same. Whereas Florida, I love everything about it. I love where I live. I love the weather. I love the restaurants. I love the lifestyle. When I'm done this interview with you, I'm heading to the beach for the day. It's just like I love the lifestyle. And I end up saying I took care of myself well enough financially. I don't really need to keep doing the grind. And what I did is 2 years ago, I said to Anthony and Andrew, do you guys want to just take these horses for me? I don't know if I'm going to ship. And I don't think they believed I was really going to do it. And I was like, Anthony took most of them because I like how Mohawk not that one's better than the other. Anthony and Andrew are both awesome, but most of my horses, I love Mohawk. How they qualify the horses, sensible there, as to oppose at the Meadowlands, you got to qualify a baby in like some ridiculous speed. Mohawk, I can qualify a lot slower. I just like everything about how you can prep a horse for a big race in Toronto over how you can prep them in the States. So I chose all Anthony. And I really don't think Anthony thought I was really going to send them all. Nobody believed me. I kept saying, I'm going to do this. I'm not coming. I'm going to prep the horses this winter and I'm sending them north. I'm not coming. And when it got closer and closer, I'm talking to Anthony. Do you have enough stalls for me? There's like 20 of them coming. Do you got room? And he's like, are you serious? Like, you're really doing this? And I'm like, I'm really doing this. You need staff. You need room. And I did it. And the first year I did it, last season or two seasons ago, we did phenomenal. We came up with the horses Nijinsky and Legendary Hanover, who Nijinsky, I'm going to say both of them made probably just under 2 million. Legendary Hanover's went to stud now. Nijinsky, he's not racing right now currently, but he's going to race again at the end of the season. And they did amazing things. We won the North American Cup for $1 million. We won the Meadowlands Pace for 700,000. We won all kinds of major, major Grand Circuit races. And Anthony did that as trainer and me as a, I prepped them in the winter and own part of them, and things just snowballed. And now I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to stick to doing this. And now I kind of decided not to even winter train no more now, though. I'm not training at all anymore. So
She's retired. Yeah. But what I want you to kind of talk about now a little bit for our listeners is how, like, who gave you the advice to save money? When did you start saving money to put it together? I mean, you're in your early 40s.
29. I'm 29.
Yeah, 29. And you're basically retired. And so how, I mean, I know you had horses that won big races and everything, but I mean, you started at a very similar place to a lot of people in the horse industry start with nothing at the bottom, right? And you've worked your way up there. So can you talk about, like, financially how you've positioned yourself to be here?
Yeah, so basically how I managed to do that is, thankfully, what taught me to do that is when I grew up in BC with my parents, nobody has nothing. Like, everybody's, you're living paycheck to paycheck. And it was hard. I grew up rough, very rough. My parents did the best they could for us, but it wasn't easy. So I saw this and I saw all kinds of people that do extremely. Then I moved to Ontario and I saw many people who, man, that guy's like a Hall of Famer and they got nothing. Like, they're not doing so good. And I'm like, what the hell? Like, you won a lot of races, made a lot of, like, what happened? And I learned that horsemen, I can't, like, gambling and partying. And I love going to the casino and partying. I used to, I don't so much so anymore. And I seen all these things happening. And I was like, I was young. I was like, I don't want that to happen to me. I don't want to be freaking 80 years old and broke and cleaning stalls for people. So I decided to start investing. And I just looked into investing people. And I'm going to say two people that really helped me at the start, Jen Rankin, who was my bookkeeper and ended up being April Campbell, those two people. And Charlene Oldham, I got to say her name out there because she's the one that started me with investing. She was like who did my mortgage on my house for me. And I met her through Jen Rankin and she's hooked me up with people to invest. And I will say when I first started, it didn't go so good. I started investing in 2008 range, which everybody knows Everything kind of tanked.
Yeah.
So it didn't go so good there. But now I'm with Barry. I can never pronounce his last name. It's Morgan Stanley. He owns Carl. He owned Manchango, But he does everything for me now. And just investing, I learned to invest. And what I did at first, like no matter what you can invest, I don't care if it's $100 a month, like whatever it is. For me, what it ended up being once I was making more money, I was making pretty good money. It was $5,000 a month that I had go out automatically out of my account. Whatever you think you can afford that you won't notice, whether it be $100, $200, $1,000, automatically put that into an investment account that goes out monthly and you don't even notice it. And it just built up. And over the time, mine, like I said, mine ended up being $5,000 a month. And whenever I would have extra money, if I won a big race, whatever, something big happened, I'd take a chunk of that money. And I just kept never see it again. Don't look at it. Don't touch it. Pretend it's not there. Let it work for you. And it just kept adding up and adding up. And then I would look at it a few years down the road. I'm like, holy smokes, like that's looking pretty good. And I got fortunate enough to have some stallions, which is what really changed my life is when I got some horses that were good enough to go to stallion. And I would take that money and invest it. And like I said, some people think, oh, I don't make enough money. I can't invest. But I'm telling you, something as simple as $100 a month, it's stupid how quickly that really builds up for you and invest and put it in something safe that's not risky and look at it down the years and starting doing it as young as I started investing. I'm 45 now and I'm retired. So, and that's it can work for you and your money's basically working for you now. So.
Yeah. Amazing. Yeah. So. I mean, that's what every kind of financial person says, like, start as early as you can and give what you can and let it amortize and you'll be, you know.
And what Barry does for me now is, like, he sends me these projection sheets where if the market's going really bad, middle, good, basically this is what we think you're safe to be able to live with. So this is how much you can spend a month and a year. This is what you got. And he does these for me and updates them all the time for me. And it was funny. He called me just the other day and he said, because sometimes I just finished putting hurricane windows in the house, which was a big expense. So I'm like, I need to take some money for this. So he goes, do you have anything big happening right now? He goes, I'm trying to, what do you say, make your lifestyle work for you. What do we need? What do we need? And what, because the markets are good right now. What do we need? And what do you need to take out? I'm trying to work on your expensive lifestyle, he says. But he's been great. If I didn't meet him, it's just, he's been awesome for me right now. So just find an investment guy that you know you can trust and that knows your goals and what you want, and tell him what you want and what your goals are, and just put that little bit away every month, and it really will add up. And it sounds crazy, but if you just, like, I look at some, one of my guilty pleasures is Starbucks, and I spend one Starbucks a day is like $200 a month. It's crazy. And I just look at something like that and I'm like, if you just took that $200 a month and didn't spend on Starbucks, it really does add up. So just something simple like that. If you just give something up that you can invest that money, it really will pay off for you years down the road.
Yeah, we just don't have a lot of people that come on that have actually done it and been disciplined enough to get where you're at, right? So this is like a true testament to it actually working if you do that and you keep investing and be disciplined about it.
Yes, for sure. And actually, just this morning when Jen sent me a reminder for this interview, she was asking me, she goes, where are you with your, she thought, like, I kind of get up a bit late now. And she's like, weren't you with your trainer early? I used to go real early every morning. I have a personal trainer I work out with. I said, well, no, I kind of, now that I'm trying to be retired, I said, she was $100 a session 5 days a week. That's $500 a week, $2,000 a month. And so I just said, I let her go and I'm doing it on my own still and everything's working good. But yeah, so exactly, be disciplined. Like, that's the other thing a lot of horsemen do in our business anyways, is they way live beyond their means. Like, people that I know are not paying their bills and owe people money and they're on a vacation. They're out for a fancy dinner. They're gambling at the casino. I love the casino, but I go there knowing that you're probably going to lose it. I'll be like, hey, listen, I'm going to go to the casino. This is going to be fun. This is how much money I'm taking. If I lose it, it's gone. Don't be mad about it, even though you're going to be mad about it. But don't go to the bank card. Don't go in for more. And right. But a lot of that's where a lot of horsemen's money go, is gambling. And they lose everything. And let's say partying and expensive vacations that they simply aren't set up for. Like, you can't go to a steakhouse for $100 right now. Like, it just, you gotta, like, when I grew up and when I was starting, I ate a lot of Kraft dinner. I ate a lot of frozen pizzas. I ate a lot of McDonald's, probably why I put on a whole lot of weight there for a little while, probably how I did that. But you got to live by your means. And definitely, I grew up rough. And when I was first starting out, I wasn't able to do what I do now. I definitely, I was eating the 99-cent box of Kraft dinner multiple nights a week.
Yeah. And looking back, like, do you think 20 years ago, you would have ever imagined where you are now?
Definitely not. Not even a little bit. No, everything. And that's the other thing I wish that young people would, like, I do wish that I realized how awesome things were going. Like, I look back at all the big races I won in that. You really don't have enough time to enjoy it. Like, honestly, I enjoyed racing and winning more there last year. The year I had with Anthony Beaton, like, I've never won the Meadowlands Pace, was a race I could never get. And we were first and second in the Meadowlands Pace, just winning some major, major races that we were able to win. I was able to enjoy it more as an owner, where I'm in the grandstand, I'm in the clubhouse and letting it sink in and enjoying it. Where when I'm racing, as soon as you win that big race, my head's like, well, we're in the next race. We got another horse in. Like, forget that $1 million race you just won. You got this Claimer race coming up that you need to go win. And to me, it didn't matter if my horse was a Claimer or a Grand Circuit Stake horse. I gave him as much attention and thought to detail. Like, there's nights where I won a major stakes races, but my cheaper horse was no good. And I go to bed, my mind just going 100 miles an hour. We got to fix that horse. What's wrong with him? Is he sick? Is he lame? Is he tired? What happened? And I find that I didn't get to enjoy it enough. Like, I just, no, I never thought I'd be where I am, for sure. And I just wish that you got to learn to enjoy the moments when you have them, because I definitely let some of that go by that I shouldn't have. And I should have let it sink in and enjoy it a little bit more than I did. I'm just too focused on business and racing, maybe.
Hmm. Did you have any kind of like identity crisis after you were, you know, decided to retire? Like, was it a struggle for you to think, well, I'm like the top level Hall of Fame level horse trainer, and now I'm not anymore. Are you okay with that?
Yeah, I'm good. Like, a lot of people seem to think that once I retire, they're like, you'll be back. And maybe I still will. I'm not 100% saying that I won't be, but saying that it's been 2 full years since I raced on my own and 1 full year since I trained, and I'm not missing it at all. Like, I keep myself busy. I work out like crazy. I go to the beach. I go to dinners. I've been traveling a lot. And these are other things I couldn't do if I didn't retire. Like, just last year, for instance, like, I traveled all over. I went to Dubai. I went to England. I went to Ireland. We went on Caribbean vacation, like, just things you simply can't do. Like, when I was racing, if I got a week off once a year, fantastic. Mm-hmm. Our vacation was when you're on the road. Like, when I go to Lexington, Kentucky to race and go to the sale, that's my vacation. Harrisburg, that's my vacation for the yearling sale. And it's just like, you just have no time for it. But yeah, just I guess I miss it a little. Like, I watch the big races, obviously, and usually it's me in the big race and they're talking about your horse. And now, like, I still have some horses that were in them. This year, we're not having that great of a year so far. Our good horse, Snijinsky, got hurt. I'm hoping he'll race the last half of the season. And a few babies that I'm managing and own a piece of, they're just not doing the greatest so far. We haven't had a great year. But so, yes, I miss that. But no, I don't think I'll be back. Saying that, I haven't completely sold all the equipment yet. So we'll see.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think especially in racing, it's such a male dominated sport. And we've talked to a few female drivers and trainers. And I was just wondering if you had anybody that you could look up to that was a female, and if any females have come to you and said, like, can you give me some advice or anything to that extent of, you know, being so well known in the industry?
Yeah, so as far as female to look up as growing up, a person I never knew, never got a chance to meet, I'm going to say, like, I want to be a driver. So Bea Farber, everybody in racing knows her. And I never got to meet her, but just seeing how good she was, it was stupid. She was better than the guys, how good of a driver she was. So I was kind of wanted to be like her. As I got training and now I got to meet her, I'm actually pretty good friends with her now, is Linda Toscano. When I was still a kid in BC, just watching her train and watching what she did, I always looked up to her. And I was fortunate enough, she actually even trained some horses for me, and we're friends now. So it's been really cool to go from a kid watching these people who I thought were just like Hall of Famer legends, and now I'm friends with them and they're training for me. So yeah, I'm going to say I definitely looked up to Linda Toscano, Bea Farber, females like that. And yeah, I've had many, many females that have come to me and asked for advice on certain things. I'm very approachable. Anybody that knows, I'm always on my social medias. I don't even know how many messages I'll get. People send me and say, hey, listen, they'll tell me about a horse or what I think, like what the horse is doing. Just one thing that sucks for me is when people ask for advice is I'm a hands-on, eyes-on kind of person. Like, people, when you tell me your situation, I'm not so good at, I need to see it. I need to see and feel the situation. So I try my best to help people. But yes, I have people from all over the world who will send me questions. Like, I'll get great big paragraphs and say, hey, this is what my horse is doing. Do you think you could help me? And I'll try my best to help them, but I kind of feel bad because I'm like, I need to see it and feel it. But when I'm there and I can see the people's horse, I have no problem trying to help them out when they ask me for advice. I've had many females say, listen, I really look up to you. The things you've done is why I'm trying. And I hope I can be like, do what you did, and I try my best to help them out the best I can. So never. Yes, it's a male dominated sport, 100%. But saying that, some of the best trainers in the world right now are females. So there's a lot of them. It's getting more and more.
That's what I was going to ask. Is the tide turning?
It's getting more and more. And when you go, like, when I went to, like, go to New Zealand and Australia, I went there like years ago on a vacation. There's a lot of female trainers and drivers, like way more than here. I don't know why that is. I don't know why there's way many down under than there is here, but there is. And look here, there's men like Lauren Triton. She drives with all the people here. I know you guys did an interview with her. She does extremely well driving against all the guys. Nancy Tack, there's a female trainer in it. She does extremely well. Like, there's all kinds of them. Like, I'm definitely missing names for sure, but there's, don't be discouraged just because you're a female in a male dominated sport. We can do it just as good as they can. So
awesome. Well, it's been really cool talking with you and learning your story. And I think it's truly inspirational to so many people in the business, whether you do, you know, driving or jumping or dressage, whatever it is. You know, I think all of those traits and showing, you know, what you've put into the sport is what matters and can really lead to a lot of success as well. So it's been great talking with you.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. And at the end of each episode, we ask the same four questions to each guest. And Connor starts with the first question.
What is your unfair advantage over others?
Unfair advantage. I know you did tell me these and I didn't really think of them. I'm going to go with my unfair advantage is how I grew up in the business. Like the fact that I grew up with absolutely nothing. And then to see once you make some stuff and make some money and make something of yourself. Like if I didn't see what I seen being young, like basically if I was one of those kids growing up with a silver spoon in your mouth, I would have never been where I was. Like there's a lot of kids nowadays that don't leave their house and just live off their parents. And I'm very glad I grew up how I grew up. So I'm going to say my unfair advantage is growing up how I did, learning to work from a young age and learning to, like, I was born and raised in the barn, which made me, I only know horses. So I basically knew a horse inside and out from the time I was born. So my unfair advantage is just growing up in the barn. It just give me, basically, I think I'm almost part horse. Like I'm very good at reading a horse and figuring out what's wrong with them, I think. So it's from growing up with them from a young age.
Yep. Yeah. Cool. And what's something worth fighting for? And what is something worth giving up?
Man, I'm going to go worth fighting for. Got to be Starbucks. I'm going with Starbucks. I don't know if that's supposed to be the answer on a horse, but I'm never giving that up. So yeah, worth fighting for Starbucks. Maybe I'll go with this one for not worth giving up is I'm going to use this as an example. I've had many horses where I found that I couldn't figure them out. I couldn't get them to go. I gave them up to help the horse itself and the owner. I would contact a different trainer and say, hey, listen, I can't figure this horse out. It's not adapting to my program. And never think that you're too good and nobody else can improve off of you. I always did what was best for the owner. So there's multiple times I would take a horse and tell the owner, I'm going to give this horse up because I simply can't figure him out. And maybe this trainer can. And I did that back when I had 100 horses. I would not figure out certain horses and say, please take this horse and try to help my owner out. And I never had too big of an ego. You can't ever have too big of a head and too big of an ego and think you're too good for everybody else, because you got to every once in a while bite the bullet and have somebody else help you figure things out.
Yeah, that's great.
What has been your favorite age so far?
Favorite age? Man, I guess I'm 45 right now. I'm going to go like last year. I was 44 last year. And last year that's the first time I did as much traveling as I did. I had a fantastic year racing the horses. Between Anthony and Andrew, we made around 4 million with like 20 horses. So I won the Meadowlands Pace, which was amazing. Both horses, one went to stud with Legendary Hanover. So the racing was great. Business was great. I traveled with my mom a lot last year. I'm single right now. So I took her with me as my date we went to Dubai. I just finished saying earlier, we went to Ireland. We went to Paris. We did the Vincent and Lanley Memorial in Ireland. That's a great trip. If anybody ever wants to do that, the VDM, they just finished doing it again just this last weekend. So if anybody wants to ever go visit Ireland for a week, look up the Vincent Delaney Memorial. I hope I'm not pronouncing that wrong.
Nope, you got it.
It's fantastic. Yeah. I went on a Caribbean vacation we went to Cancun with my mom to this 5-star resort for a week. So I've traveled a lot at 44. We won a lot of big races, had a lot of fun. So yeah, 44 was my favorite age.
Sounds like a good.
Yeah. Awesome. Is it cool to be able to give your mom something like that now, knowing she could never do that when she was younger?
Yeah, for sure. Like the first trip I took her on was the VDM, and I was thinking about going as him and Han. I said, would you be interested? She's like, that would be the trip of a lifetime. And she'd love to. So I brought her. We had a great time. After we spent 2 weeks, we also went to England. We went to Paris and we traveled around Europe for 2 weeks. That was great. And then I remember I was invited on this Cancun 5-star resort. And I ended up saying, it was last minute I booked, like literally like 2 weeks before we're going. And I was invited and I didn't think I'd still be single at the time, but I was. And I didn't want to go solo. And I messaged mom. I said, any chance you want to go? She's like, of course I'd want to go. And so then she said, that was a trip of a lifetime. And then last minute, Jonathan Drury and his girlfriend Vicky said, hey, we're going to Dubai. Any chance you want to go to Dubai with us? I'm thinking, I messaged mom. Any thoughts on going to Dubai? She's like, oh my God, I would love to. So so I feel bad for my dad because he hasn't gotten to go on all these cool trips. I just kept like, I'm sharing a bedroom with her. So I don't really want to share a hotel with my dad as much as my mom. So I ended up saying to her, I said, you're going to be really disappointed once I end up having somebody again that is going to take up your travel spot. But it's been awesome being able to get to know her. We're actually leaving on Wednesday. I'm going with my mom and my dad's coming this time. Even their dog Batman's going. We're going to Grants Pass, Oregon for 10 days to go visit my aunts who live in Grants Pass, Oregon. So it's kind of a family trip. So that should be fun. And we're all going. So
that's awesome. Good.
And our last question is, who would you recommend as a guest for this podcast?
I'm going to go with Linda Toscano. Linda Toscano, she, as far as I know, and don't quote me on this, but I think she pretty much didn't come from a whole lot either. I think she started from the ground up also. She's won everything. She's won the Hamiltonian, which is a race I'll never win because it's with trotters. She's had amazing horses, an unbelievable career. She's still doing it. Like I'm not sure her age, but she's older than me and she's still doing it. She fought through cancer at one point. I believe it was breast cancer. She's probably got a pretty amazing story. So I'm going to go with Linda Toscano for sure.
Yeah, she'd be great.
Well, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Yeah, it's awesome.
No problem. Thanks, Casey. No problem. Thanks for having me.
Hey, if you're over the sugar-coated stories and want the real unfiltered side of the horse world, come ride with us.
I'm Maria Falgioni, former jockey turned businesswoman.
And I'm Cheyenne Wimberly, rail racer and rodeo veteran. We're pulling back the curtain on the horse world, the wins, the wild stories, and the things nobody else wants to say out loud.
Serious topics, zero stuffy vibes.
Search Gallop and Gossip wherever you get your podcast and bring your tea because we've got plenty to spill.
I love talking to Casey. I mean, I've chatted with her before. I've known her story. And she's so inspirational because, like I said, she started at the bottom. Very similar situation to me. We've taken completely different roads where I didn't go into training or wanting to be around the horses or any of that. And she kind of took the family business and ran with it and grew it. And she just, I mean, she's so young and she really was able to just, not just in the training world, but like know what she wanted. She's a very disciplined person and get there.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't know her story at all. And it's unbelievable, you know, what she came from and what she went through with her injuries and to grow that much. And I thought it was going to be like, oh, I did this over 10 to 15 years, 3 years. She went from having never trained a horse to having 130 horses in her barn. That is unbelievable. And to keep that going and have the consistency and the winning and keeping owners happy and keeping employees happy, like that is just what a story. And it was so cool to hear it from her point of view and to, you know, be able to recognize those accomplishments. I mean, the winning is great and, you know, all of her lifetime earnings and the Hall of Fames, and that's cool. But to be able to have that success and be able to provide such a comfortable life for yourself is just a huge accomplishment. I don't know.
Yeah.
Like you said, she's inspirational and she did it all, you know, I think you can talk more to this point, but she did it all with thinking of the horse first. You know, like she said, she wanted to know every single little thing that might be wrong with the horse so they could take care of it. And, you know, she really put the horses first, you know, and
yeah, having 100
hours that she did. Yeah.
having 132 horses, hiring the right people to help you. But also, one thing we didn't really touch on in the podcast, but I know about Casey, is she's very strict in her barn. There's no yelling in her barn. There's no hitting on horses in her barn. I mean, there's even a situation where she had a stud horse who was pretty aggressive, and she made the staff paint the area outside of his stall and put up cones so that they would avoid it, because he could grab somebody over the top of the gate, but she didn't want to take the gate away from him and put a full screen on him and not let him have his head out and be a horse and interact in the barn. She thought that would probably change his attitude and make him grumpy and not as good of a racehorse. So she works with the horses that she has. And then, like she said there at the end, if there's a horse that she can't figure out, she's going to do right by the horse and send it someplace else. Right. Like, if it's not for her, it's not for her. And one thing about Casey, she knows her lane, right? So in standardbreds, there's trotters and pacers. She's not a trotter person. She might have dabbled, tried a little bit, but she knows she's not a trotter person. Like she said, she's never going to win the Hambletonian because she's not a trotter person. She knows her lane. She's very good at both fillies and colts in pacing bloodlines. She knows that conformation. They have different conformation than trotters, and she knows her pacing conformation well. And, you know, that's what she's been able to be successful on and consistent with. And you're right. She puts the horses first all the time. She gives one off. She doesn't let trainers like dictate and bully her into doing things with the horses that she's not going to do, where a lot of people, a trainer will be like, oh, do we have to? Does it need time? That's going to cost us money. Money is never in the equation with Casey. And for somebody who grew up without financial backing from her parents, to be able to have that mindset and just do it is amazing to me.
Yeah, definitely. And you meant owners, not trainers.
Yeah, owners. Yeah,
owners pressuring her. Pressuring her. Yeah. Horses.
Yeah, you know, it's financially not good for them if horses sit in the barn. Well, you know what? That's what the horse needs. That's what the horse is going to get. So,
yeah. And, you know, she was quick to point out everybody who helped her and everybody that, you know, led to the success. And yes, she had, you know, like Merlin in the beginning, who was an incredible person to support her like he did. But there's only so far you can go with somebody handing you opportunities if you don't make something of it.
Yes.
And she really took what she was given and made something of it. And I just think it's such a cool story.
Yeah, that's why I wanted to have her on. And, you know, I've wanted to have her on for a while, but getting her to pin her down has been a little tough.
Been traveling a lot.
Yeah. So now she's retired. She's got time for us. But
yes.
But anyway, yeah, because I just think that people need to see that. And the one thing I also love about Casey is with her guys that have gone out on their own and her retaining a relationship, I think that people in other parts of the industry could learn something from that. Yeah. That it's, you know, that it shouldn't be like hard feelings when somebody decides that they want to move on. And, and you know, like I was talking about the Todd Pletcher interview and them talking about him, like we would be well served to help people get to their end goals than be upset with them for having those goals.
Right. And then, like we've said before, you know, if you have a horse that's not working for you, but you're like, you know what, Anthony or Andrew would be perfect with this horse. Mm-hmm. And then you have a place to send a horse where you know they're going to be treated well. You know what you're, you know, getting into, and that it'll be okay for them to go there. I think, you know, that is really invaluable when you're working with horses and you've brought somebody along. They leave and start their own thing, but you have somebody in the industry you can trust that you know. And I, you know, that it touches on a lot of themes that we have spoken about before.
Treating your employees well, right? Yeah. I mean, and you know, and she has high expectations, but she also rewards those high expectations.
Right.
So.
Well, it was
a pleasure talking to her. She's funny too.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad you got to talk with her and that we could share her story with everybody. And maybe we'll rope her into an EQBW meeting somewhere along the way too. Yeah, I think that would be a fun like crossover.
Yeah. And she's still got that Canadian accent.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, she is a dual citizen. Her mother is American, but she's a dual citizen. And so she spent a lot of time in Canada first. So
right.
I don't know. That's probably never going away.
Nope. Your New York accent didn't go anymore.
Exactly. I wish it would sometimes, though, honestly. Well, we're going to wrap up, and you can find the links to today's guest and the show notes at www.eqbusinesswomen.com. Equestrian B2B is out twice a month on the 1st and the 15th.
You can find out more at eqbusinesswomen.com and follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Find Equestrian B2B wherever you get your podcasts and be sure to follow, subscribe, and leave a review.
Now go be disciplined.